Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 11th of March, these are our main stories. The movie Oppenheimer has swept the board at the Oscars with 7 awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. We have the latest on the winners and losers from the Academy Awards in Los Angeles. The start of Ramadan brings no relief for the people of Gaza. What are described as technical difficulties mean an aid ship bound for Gaza is still stuck in Cyprus. Caribbean leaders are meeting in Jamaica to discuss fears of famine and growing anarchy in Haiti. Also in this podcast, Princess Kate says sorry over the international confusion caused by her editing of a family photograph. And actor Idris Elba dreams big for his mum and Sierra Leone with a smart city.
Part of me wants to build that beautiful retirement home for my mum. It's a dream, but I work in the make-believe business and it's exactly that.
We start with the 96th Oscars, the Academy Awards ceremony where the blockbuster biopic Oppenheimer was crowned Best Picture, winning 7 Oscars in total. Unlike past years, where films few had seen sometimes won honours, Oppenheimer was a crowd pleaser with nearly $1 billion in ticket sales. So for more on the winners and losers and all you need to know from the glitz and glamour of the red carpet, the BBC's culture editor, Katie Razzle, sent this report from Los Angeles.
And welcome to the 96th Oscars, everybody. Look at these.
It started as we knew it was going to go on. An Oscars with few major surprises. The first award, Best Supporting Actress, Davine Joy Randolph, the favourite for months for her stunning performance in The Holdovers.
For so long, I've always wanted to be different. And now I realise I just need to be myself.
And the Oscar goes to Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. has been himself through the Oscars race and was a dead cert for Best Supporting Actor for Oppenheimer.
I'd like to thank my terrible childhood.
Oppenheimer has been the front runner in so many categories, and the big awards went as predicted.
We're in a race against the Nazis.
Best Actor for Cillian Murphy as the theoretical physicist often dubbed the father of the atomic bomb.
For better or for worse, we're all living in Oppenheimer's world, so I would really like to dedicate this to the peacemakers everywhere.
7 awards for Christopher Nolan's film in all, including Best Director and Best Picture. The first time in years that a big-budget, widely watched movie has won that top award. But then Nolan makes art house blockbusters.
Movies are just a little bit over 100 years old. We don't know where this incredible journey is going from here, but to know that you think that I'm a meaningful part of it means the world to me. Thank you very much.
And the winner is...
Poor Things.
Poor Things.
Poor Things.
Oppenheimer was blocked from a truly record-breaking night by Poor Things, a host of predominantly British talent in costume, makeup and production design, rewarded for the hugely original world they created.
And the Oscar goes to Emma Stone.
And Emma Stone, the star, walking away with Best Actress.
It's not about me. It's about a team that came together to make something greater than the sum of its parts.
Have you told all the truths?
Stone's win meant history wasn't made by Lily Gladstone, who could have become the first Native American to win an acting Oscar. But there were other records made. The Holocaust film, The Zone of Interest, is the first British movie to win Best International Feature. Its director is Jonathan Glazer.
Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanisation. How do we resist?
Ukraine won its first Oscar for the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol. The Academy's more international makeup was also reflected in the original screenplay Oscar for the French legal drama Anatomy of a Fall. Justin Trier is co-writer and director.
Thank you so much. It will help me through my midlife crisis, I think.
And while Barbie may have only won one Oscar and for a different song, Ryan Gosling's rendition of I'm Just Ken in a hot pink suit with the legendary guitarist Slash stole the show.
I'm just Ken, anywhere else I'd be too.
That report by Katie Razzle. The screenwriter Nazin Chowdhury is a Londoner now living in LA who was nominated for an Oscar for Best Short Film for her directorial debut called Red, White and Blue. It chronicles the immensely painful reality of America's politics of abortion. She didn't win, but just before heading to Elton John's after party, she did take a call from us. Amal Rajan asked her about what must be mixed emotions.
You know, we were so happy to have been nominated. It was beyond our expectations even to reach the nomination stage, just because we're so independent. We just put this film together through a lot of hard labor and love. Although we didn't win in the end, we hope we still told a story that was worth telling.
And tell us about that story, because for those who haven't seen it, Red, White and Blue really kind of ruminates, to put it mildly, on the very, very divisive and painful abortion politics of America. Those politics have gone through massive ructions in recent years, including a June 2022 decision in what became known as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Just tell us what the motivation for the film was.
Well, it was exactly what you say. In June 2022, that decision, which then also had the knock-on effect of Roe v. Wade being overturned and legislation almost immediately being enacted in certain states that really set up obstacles for people getting that health care. And so I wrote this in July 2022 and we filmed it last March, just decided that we needed to tell a very characterful and human story that transcended politics. You know, this is not something that should be divisive. It's health care. And so even though it's become very contentious, we set about trying to tell a story that showed all the reasons why it shouldn't be that way and why we should just really look at another person who needs just compassion in terms of the predicaments that they might find themselves in that requires this kind of procedure.
Screenwriter Nazrin Chowdhury. And after the success of Oppenheimer at the Oscars, you can find out more about the race to make the atomic bomb with a podcast from the BBC World Service. To hear about the scientists and the spies who changed history, search for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts. For many Muslims in the Middle East, the start of the holy month of Ramadan is overshadowed by the Gaza conflict. One man, whose wife died in Gaza, told the BBC that people there are not fasting, they're starving. Juliet Toomer is from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
This Ramadan is going to be a very sad one. People in Gaza were very much looking forward to a ceasefire or a sort of a pause. They're absolutely exhausted, understandably, after 5 months of a very brutal war. And it's going to be very difficult to have, that one meal a day where people break the fast.
It's now 5 months since the Hamas attacks that killed more than 1,000 people. A truce between Israel and Hamas, which is regarded as a terrorist group by many Western governments, remains elusive, and there are renewed fears of the violence spreading. Just before we recorded this podcast, our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell in Jerusalem gave us the latest on the fighting in Gaza.
Well, Israeli media are actually saying that Israel's checking at the moment if Hamas's second highest military leader has been killed in an Israeli airstrike. This after, of course, talks stumbled to secure a new truce in the war to coincide with Ramadan. I mean, if that death is confirmed, he would be the highest ranking official from Hamas to be killed in this war that's gone on now for more than 5 months. Israeli army radio saying that Israel's been bombing the Nusrat camp in the centre of Gaza on Saturday night. It had intelligence, it says, about the location of this senior figure there. And we understand from one of the newspapers, Haaretz, that Israel's checking if these fatalities reported that night include this man. Now, otherwise, you can see that the fighting still goes on in Gaza. We had pictures early this morning showing smoke rising up from Rafah shortly after dawn, as local people would have begun their day of fasting. One local journalist told us a car was targeted, also an agricultural area on the Egyptian border, and that three people were killed due to shelling of a family house in the east of Rafah. In Khan Yunis, which has, of course, been the main focus of Israel's southern offensive, there have been residential blocks demolished by Israel in the Hamad city complex. Still heavy gunfire and shelling in Khan Yunis.
And violence in Jerusalem?
Well, it remains extremely tense in Jerusalem today. Relative relatively quiet as most people begin their day of fasting. We've still got thousands of Israeli police deployed, particularly around the Old City and the narrow streets of Jerusalem. Reports last night that when the customary prayers were taking place after Ramadan was announced, that several hundred people were denied access. There are some social media videos. You can see the police using their batons there.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, a ship carrying aid for Gaza has been delayed leaving Cyprus. Here's Quentin Somerville.
The aid ship, the Open Arms, and its barge of 200 tonnes of food supplies were expected to leave Cyprus at the weekend, but both remain docked in Larnaca port. The charity behind the plan, World Central Kitchen, blamed technical difficulties for the delay, but said it hoped to leave as soon as possible. It would be the first time that aid had been delivered by sea to Gaza, which has no functioning port. The charity is building a jetty to receive the supplies. If the ship successfully delivers its cargo, then more ships will follow as part of a new maritime relief corridor. The situation inside Gaza is desperate. Children are dying of malnutrition, and the UN warns that famine is almost inevitable.
Quentin Somerville. The Princess of Wales has apologised for any confusion surrounding a photo of herself and her children released to celebrate Mothering Sunday. Big news agencies had withdrawn it, saying it had been digitally manipulated. We heard more from our correspondent, Sophie Long.
The Princess of Wales has actually posted on social media, on X, formerly Twitter, and she said that, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused. I hope everyone celebrating had a very happy Mother's Day. And that's just signed off C. So that a post from the Princess of Wales explaining why it had been digitally manipulated. Now, of course, this was a lovely photo that was released yesterday for Mothering Sunday, and it shows the Princess of Wales with her three children hugging them, and they appear to be roaring with laughter. And that's what it was supposed to do, celebrate Mother's Day. But of course, there has been an intense level of interest in the Princess of Wales' health since she had surgery and spent 13 days in hospital in London. And of course, this was the first time we've seen her since Christmas Day. That was the last public duty she carried out. So there was a huge amount of speculation that they were hoping the palace this would put an end to. But of course, it appeared to create more questions than answers. In terms of Kensington Palace, they have said that this was an amateur family photograph taken by the Prince of Wales. The Royal Highnesses wanted to offer an informal picture of the family together for Mother's Day. And the Princess made minor adjustments, as she shared in her statement on social media. Now, we'll see how the rest of social media reacts to that. But, you know, many people take pictures with their mobile phones these days, and a huge number of people, of course, will edit those slightly before they post them on social media. So many people will think this was an entirely normal thing to do.
The photo grabbed the attention of the world because there is so much interest in her health. How is she doing?
Well, of course, we know very little about that. There's been intense speculation, but the picture released yesterday appeared to show her looking very healthy. It was a picture of health, really. We await for further confirmation of when she will be coming back to public duties. We have been led to believe that will be after Easter. We're expecting to see her next month, but we haven't been given any confirmation of the date that she will be coming back to public duties. Today, of course, there'll be Commonwealth Day celebrations. We're expecting to see Prince William out and about, so I'm sure there'll be more questions for him.
Sophie Long. A technical event during the flight caused a strong movement. That was how the airline LATAM described how one of its flights from Sydney to Auckland suddenly dipped in the air. 50 people were injured. Some were taken to hospital. Brian Jokat was on board and was not injured. He's now in Auckland and has been talking to the BBC.
The plane, unannounced, just dropped. I mean, it dropped unlike anything I've ever experienced on any kind of minor turbulence. And people were thrown out of their seats, hit the top of the roof of the plane, thrown down the aisles. It was madness. The gentleman sitting next to me basically was lifted out of his seat, and he was on the inside, basically stretched out. And I looked up and I thought I was dreaming, because I was in a bit of a sleep when I awoke from this. And I looked up and noticed what's going on here. And then he just dropped to the floor. And I looked over my shoulder just to see what else was going on. And some of the roof panels were broken from people being thrown up and knocking through the plastic roof panels in the aisleways. And there was blood coming from several people's heads, and people were yelling and screaming, and it was chaos. The plane actually dropped, and then it felt as if you were at the apex of a roller coaster coming over the top and heading down, and then it straightened up right away. I just felt for all of the injured people, because then a couple of passengers let it be known they were doctors, and they started to circulate to bandage people up and stop the bleeding on some people and put neck braces on other people that were severely injured. And once we landed, it was like elation, but it was dead silent from the people that were okay. And the other people, they were just constantly, you know, in pain.
Passenger Brian Jokat. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
My personal feeling is that it is probably one of the biggest addictions in the world. And it's the only addiction, of course, just about that you get marked positively for. You know, you get points for it.
We hear how a workaholic dealt with his addiction and says it needs to be taken more seriously.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
The World Food Programme has warned that people in the Haitian capital are facing famine conditions as the security situation deteriorates. Armed gangs have seized control of much of the city. The airport has been closed, and reports say the port and food stores have been looted. Jean-Martin Bauer, a WFP representative in Haiti, said 1.6 million people in Port-au-Prince were in dire straits.
I remind you that you've got more than 360,000 Haitians who've been displaced by the violence. That's essentially a doubling of the numbers in the past few months. And this population that's been displaced has lost everything. Often their houses have been burned by the armed groups. People are on the move and have no resources.
As we record this podcast, leaders of the Caribbean regional bloc CARICOM are meeting in Jamaica to discuss the crisis. Our Central America and Caribbean correspondent Will Grant reports.
Haiti is fast descending into anarchy. Over the past few nights, the violence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, has ramped up once again. Heavily armed groups attacked the National Palace and set part of the Interior Ministry on fire with Molotov cocktails. It comes after a sustained attack on the international airport, which remains closed to all flights, including one carrying the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry. He recently attempted to fly back to Haiti, but his plane was refused permission to land and was also turned away from the neighbouring Dominican Republic. He's now stuck in Puerto Rico, unable to return to the nation he ostensibly leads. With no prime minister and the government in disarray, the gang's grip of the capital is near absolute. They control over 80% of Port-au-Prince, and the country's most notorious gang leader, Jimmy Cherizier, nicknamed Barbecue, told Prime Minister Henri to resign in chilling language. If Ariel Henri doesn't step down and the international community continues to support him, he told the gathered media, they will lead us directly to a civil war which will end in genocide. Meanwhile, the police, outnumbered and demoralised, are struggling to keep looters at bay. The Salomon police station was attacked and burnt out, charred vehicles lying outside the still smouldering building. In the State University of Haiti Hospital, commonly known as the General Hospital in downtown Port-au-Prince, the situation is dire. There is no sign of any medical staff at all. In one bed, covered by a sheet and swarming with flies, a dead body lies next to patients waiting in vain for treatment. No one has come to remove the deceased, and the body is rapidly decomposing in the Caribbean heat. There are no doctors. They all fled last week, said Philippe, a patient who didn't want to give his real name. We can't go outside. We hear the explosions and gunfire, so we must have courage and stay here. We can't go anywhere. Nevertheless, even in the total collapse of law and order, people are still venturing out to make a living amid the chaos. These market sellers see no other option than to leave their homes even while gunmen roam the streets.
I have three kids. I'm their mother and their father. Some are obliged to take to the streets. Yesterday, gunmen came here and stole all our money. A lot of vendors lost all of their money. But there's no way to stay at home and you have three mouths to feed. What can you do?
I don't feel good. My children don't either. The anxiety is killing me when I'm in the street. I keep thinking, what if I get shot dead? Who will take care of my children then? I have no family to support me.
An already chaotic and deeply dangerous situation in Port-au-Prince was worsened by the escape of around 4,000 inmates after the gangs attacked the city's main prison. In the aftermath, cell doors are wide open, the facility is virtually abandoned, and there are bloodstains on the ground after gunmen easily overpowered the guards. A prime minister unable to return, violent gangs in charge, and dead bodies waiting to be picked up off the streets. All in all, it adds up to a picture of a nation about as close to a failed state as it's possible to be.
Will Grant. There's a spate of kidnappings in Nigeria at the moment, with hundreds of schoolchildren still missing after three separate attacks. Now, a government agency says schools in 14 states, that's nearly half the country, are vulnerable to such abductions. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton told me more about what the agency said.
This agency was created after the notorious Chibok abduction almost exactly 10 years ago. They have collected data looking at all these kidnappings over the years and the recent spate, as you say, and they've listed 14 states. I'm not going to go through all of them, but they're mainly ones in the north of the country, like Katsina, Sokoto, Plateau, Zamfara, Borno, and as well as the capital, Abuja. And they're saying that they will heighten security and there'll be more patrols, but it'll be difficult for them to put security guards in every school in the country. And some of them are in remote villages, so it's quite difficult to see what they'll do next. But they are looking at the problem and saying they're going to increase security.
What is causing this upsurge in kidnappings and who's carrying them out?
Yeah, so the Nigerian economy is in a dire situation. The currency is plummeting. The cost of living has gone up. Inflation's gone up. People can't really afford to make a living. And so many people are resorting to criminal activities. So in many cases, these are kidnappings for ransom by criminal gangs. And we suspect, although officially paying a ransom has been outlawed, we suspect that negotiations are going on behind the scenes. In other cases, for example, in the recent one last Thursday in Kaduna State, where more than 280 schoolgirls were abducted, it's thought that these are Islamist militants, for example, Ansaru, that is linked to Al-Qaeda, and then further east, Boko Haram operates. But they've not claimed responsibility yet.
Richard Hamilton. The centre-right Democratic Alliance Party has narrowly won the snap election in Portugal, which was triggered when the Prime Minister António Costa resigned amid corruption allegations. His party, the Socialists, came second. Only the far-right Chega could claim a clear-cut success, quadrupling its seats in Parliament. The Democratic Alliance is the biggest single party but didn't win an absolute majority. Still, its leader, Luis Montenegro, has ruled out any deal with Chega, which he's previously described as racist.
We know the challenge is great. We know that it will require a great sense of responsibility from everyone. We know that it will require from us, and me in particular, a great capacity for dialogue and democratic tolerance. De diálogo e tolerância
democrática. So, what options are available to Mr. Montenegro and the Democratic Alliance? A question I posed to the BBC's Alison Roberts in Lisbon.
The election is theoretically not over yet because there are four seats elected by emigrant voters, Portuguese living abroad, that have yet to be decided and probably won't be in until about the 20th of March. That may or may not affect the final result. Probably the Democratic Alliance will still be ahead. But it will have to govern alone. But the question is how long? Because given that the leader has said that he will not talk to Shega, and it is expected that the president of the country, who's above party politics, will hold him to that very public pledge. The question is, how long can a minority government survive when it will want to, for example, put forward an amending budget to change all the things that the socialist government has had in place? And then later in the year, it's going to have to table a budget of its own for next year. And where is it going to get those votes for to get that budget through, if not from Shega?
So why this big surge in support for Shega?
Well, it's been coming for a few years. Mr. Ventura himself was first elected in 2019. And at that time, he was the sole member of parliament for Shega. In 2022, when we had another election, he bumped that up to 12 seats, and he's now on 48, so literally quadrupling the number of seats, and really doing very well, particularly in the south of the country, which is the old stamping ground of Portugal's century-old Communist Party, which has really faded in recent years. So the communists were, to an extent, something of a protest vote against the two main parties. Perhaps that's been taken over by Shega. And indeed, Shega in the Algarve region was the most voted party. So there are clearly some regional factors here. But in general, given that the abstention level of abstention went down very sharply, many commentators are saying, well, these are a lot of discontented people who are sick of the two main parties and now want to vote for Shega. But of course, we can't say that for sure until we see studies saying exactly who these people are and whether they voted at all last time or indeed voted for another party.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon. Now, are you obsessed with working, spending long, excessive hours in the office and finding it difficult to stop thinking about work? Well, the British writer James Graham has told the BBC about attending Workaholics Anonymous for his addiction, which he claims is not treated as seriously as when people are hooked on drugs or alcohol.
I think the moment I realised I had a problem was I'd started to lie to my family and my friends about stupid things that didn't even need lying about. Like, they would go, "You look tired, what time did you get up today to work?" And I would say, "Oh, you know, 8. And I'd say to myself, "But I know I got up at 5. That's really weird. Why did I say that?" Or I wouldn't have eaten for a whole day.
The writer James Graham. Gary from Workaholics Anonymous told his story to my colleague Amal Rajan.
I was working as an executive in media, and I think it got to the stage where I was so obsessed with work that I had got myself into a kind of mindset that I just wasn't doing enough, and that if I wasn't superhuman and, you know, living up to my nickname of the Dragon Slayer and bringing in millions of pounds worth of work, that everyone was talking about me and that I was going to be sacked. I'd even sort of thought, well, it'd be perfectly reasonable if they called the police and accused me of fraud because I simply wasn't bringing in enough work, you know? So I thought, I'll be preemptive and resign. And then when I resigned, people were just like shocked and thought, but we love having you here. You're the grown-up. You're the adult. You hold the place together. We need you. My personal feeling is that it is probably one of the biggest addictions in the world. And it's the only addiction, of course, just about that you get marked positively for, you know, you get points for it, you know. Alcoholism and drug addiction have got their kind of moral sort of bad image, but workaholism, yeah.
What's the treatment and what have you pursued as treatment?
Workaholics Anonymous is very like Alcoholics Anonymous based on that. And largely it's a program of just other workaholics helping each other to realize that it is actually okay to take 5 minutes every hour to go for a pee break. It is actually okay to say to your boss at 6:30, "I'm sorry, but I have to leave," you know. Just putting in simple boundaries. What is a good amount of hours to work a week? What's, you know, the absolute maximum I'll work? All of those things are very simple, but for a workaholic whose head is full of, "I need approval from my authority figures," you need the support of a group to say, "No, no, it's okay. Keep going. Keep learning to relax." There is so much shame and sense of self and self-esteem wrapped up in work that it's when you're with a bunch of people who have very similar kind of warped mindset, shall we say, that you start to think, yeah, well, these people are like me. They get where my crazy head's coming from.
And how are you now, Gary?
Oh, great. You know, I've been doing this for 14 years and I've retired, which for a workaholic is another kind of challenge, shall we say, you know, because you don't have to have a job to be a workaholic. You can run around with far too many hobbies.
Gary from Workaholics Anonymous. So we've been talking about the Oscars, and now we're going to end this podcast hearing from another movie star. But it's not to do with Hollywood. It's to do with green energy in Africa. The actor in question is Idris Elba, who's leading a regeneration project in Sierra Leone. It's an eco-city on the rural Sherbro Island off the coast of West Africa, with a wind and solar farm. Fewer than a third of homes in Sierra Leone have electricity. Our business reporter David Waddle asked Idris Elba why Sherbro Island was chosen.
Originally, we went there looking at how could we bring tourism to the most incredible 19 miles of beachfront that was there. And then we saw something a bit more innovative, a bit more exciting, was this idea of building a sort of eco-smart city, preserving what's beautiful about it, but in the same time, attracting partners to help build it out, if you like, and explore it. So that's how it came about.
This is essentially a commercial project. I guess you're looking at profits. Will Sierra Leone, the people of Sierra Leone, see those profits?
When you talk about profits, it's really about, are we ever going to make a profit? I don't think so, but it's about being self-reliant. It's about bringing an economy that feeds itself, that has growth potential. I'm very keen to sort of reframe the way Africa is viewed. We often view the framing of Africa as an aid model, and this opportunity is completely different.
Sherbro Island is somewhere that until now has been focused on fishing and agriculture. You're now talking about developing a tourism industry. Is this somewhere I should be looking at for our next family holiday?
Yes, we want to find a destination in West Africa that attracts business as well as holidaymakers, as well as innovation. I'm a filmmaker. I have a dream to have a really amazing film studio there that has a sort of Universal Studios type theme. So my roller coaster is over there and my movie over there. I think you and your family will go to a place where there's winter sun. It's 7 hours away from Europe for the most part, and it's beautiful.
And Idris, what is it that's inspired you to lend not just your passion, but also your name to a project like this?
Never in my lifetime would I have thought I could help build the foundation for a new smart city. No, I'm not qualified for that, but I am qualified to dream big. And my parents came to this country when they were young, late 60s, with the aspirations of going home. My mum's still alive, but my dad isn't. So part of me wants to build that beautiful retirement home for my mum, where she can go back and say, wow, my little guy that was born in Hackney came back home and built this incredible island. And it's a dream, but I work in the make-believe business, and it's exactly that, make-believe, you know?
Actor Idris Elba. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.